Welcome to Living Hormoniously, an ever-expanding revolution of women, embracing their bodies and their extraordinary natural rhythms to enhance all aspects of life. Over the course of this debut season of the Living Hormoniously podcast, we've had conversations with female firefighters, with film stars and rock stars. We've talked about menopause, sex and dying, perimenopause and aboriginality, how to use your cycle to better your business, provided education and awareness of the various phases of the cycle, puberty as well as postpartum, and at the heart, we've hopefully hit home again and again how the knowledge of what's going on in your body creates a much more harmonious and empowered relationship with self and with the world around you. My name's Lissy Turner, and this is the final episode of Season 1 of Living Hormoniously, the podcast, and we are bringing this home strong and deep. Each and every woman in her reproductive years is different week to week, day to day, and moment to moment. Even when life is coasting along, we can be plagued by uncertainty and then filled with confidence. Nothing has changed externally, but the internal landscape is ever shifting. Imagine for a moment the intensity of those ebbs and flows in a time of extreme tragedy. How does the body respond? How does the limbic system that carries messages from the outside world impress on the pituitary gland that makes decisions about how fertile or not we will be in any given month? In this episode, we're diving into conversation with an extraordinary woman, a woman who radiates flowers, literally. Her Instagram feed, Our Little Flower Farm, is an explosion of color, life and nature, of a beauty in flowers that is unparalleled. Underneath sits the story of an incredible life of adventure and of the vastest grief that resides in this human experience. So nestle in deep for this one as we look at the impact of tragedy on the cycle and how the cycle impacts grief and, of course, the capacity of one woman to step forward to whatever presents.
My name is Hannah Robertson and I'm 44 years old.
Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So generally when I'm interviewing people, I don't talk about the time of the day that we happen to be having a chat, but I think in this case it's quite relevant. Tell me why it is that we are chatting with each other at 6 a.m.
Well, there's a couple of reasons. Realistically, when I woke up this morning, my husband said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I like this time of day now," which for the first half of my life so far, or more than that, three quarters, I really didn't enjoy this time of day. And then the fact that there are six other people that could wake up at any moment and want to join in the conversation is the other reason. It's a bit of alone time.
So you've got six sleeping people in your house at the moment. You're up doing this to avoid the conversation carnage that could fall out from there. So you've got your husband, as you mentioned. Tell me about the five other people who are slumbering right now while we chat.
Three daughters and two sons, all quarantining because that's how life is at the moment. I actually do get out quite a bit, and because of my work, I get to leave the house and go and be by myself somewhere else. But yeah, this is our big rowdy family, the way we like it.
I'm really curious about this, and you know, we've chatted a lot over the years. It's been a long history together, but I've never actually talked to you about your child having desires or thoughts that you had before you dived into having six children.
Not many thoughts.
Not many.
Thoughts aren't what make babies, Lissy.
So there was never a vision. There was never a vision that you grow up and have six children.
Probably the opposite, actually. I do remember really young thinking, how do you make life work? So from little, it felt like a pressure. There was a pressure in me about, I think it was the way I was raised as well, which was, I was told quite clearly from young that my parents were together before we came along. They'd be together after we left. And good luck with it, really. You know, it was quite a separate feeling that I don't know if my siblings felt that way, but that's what I picked up on.
You were a character, almost like a temporary character in the longevity of their story.
That's what was communicated to me personally. And I've thought about that a lot over the years, particularly in the last few years. So what that did in me was create this constant kind of thought process around how I would make life work. It felt like a pressure because at the same time, I don't remember being shared any skills about how to do that verbally or physically or intentionally at all. So quite young, I had my first baby at 18, not as a desire logically to start a family and this is my world, but actually I do remember that feeling of, oh, hey, little guy, here we go. And that came quite quick, but never was there a thought of I'm going to have a huge family. Now when people question the amount of children I have, which comes with questions about if we're religious, are we in a cult, you know, all these things, I just say to people now, I always wanted a large family, but actually in truth, there was no concept of that in the beginning.
In truth, you were just an incredibly fertile human being.
So fertile. my husband calls them oops, 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 oops and oops.
From falling pregnant quite young, and I met you at that time when you were carrying your first baby, your baby boy kind of Blue. Mm-hmm. And what struck me at that time, because I was pregnant at the same time, 2 years old, 20 years of age, with my first child, and in the frantic nature of my young woman experience, what struck me about meeting you is just how incredibly steady and centered as a human being that you felt. You were further along in your pregnancy than I was. And I just remember being almost startled by the possibility that you could be young and pregnant and extremely grounded. Do you think that was always your nature, or did that develop through that first pregnancy?
That's always been a part of my nature. Some people that may know me may, or feel that they know me, or have had experience with me, may not know that part of my nature. But I can picture that meeting. I can picture it in my mind's eye so clearly. I know exactly where we were standing when we first spoke, which is just amazing, really, through all of the experiences of life. And I can remember your feeling and actually giving you some support in that stage, because you were kind of going, oh, I don't really know about how I feel. So yeah, I can access that woman, and she was really confident in the process of being pregnant and giving birth. I attribute that somewhat to my pregnancy hormones. They really suit me. I've always really enjoyed how I feel personally. I feel strong. I feel clear. I enjoy being pregnant. So I was pretty sure and comfortable. I'd been working with a home birth midwife as her assistant since I was 16. So I knew what birthing was about. I knew from her very clearly that I could trust the hormones that kicked in during labor, and I felt good.
How aware were you of the nature of your cycle and its fluctuations to know when you were fertile and when you weren't? If they were all oops, oops, oops and oops, which relationship was there with the knowledge of your own cycle when you were younger?
Yeah, not to the depth of understanding the different stages or having names as they do now, but I was well aware of the windows of fertility, when it was a good time and when it was a time that I could fall pregnant. So yeah, I always had that information, and I attribute that to working with a midwife and those conversations with the group of women that I chose to be around, the older women, as a teenager. Those conversations were more free-flowing. They weren't in my childhood home. I don't remember having those conversations. I don't really remember talking about anything to do with bleeding or cycles much at all, other than with my grandma, who put a present in my cupboard when I was about 11 for one fine spring day. And it was a packet of giant big surfboard like pads. And I was like, I wasn't allowed to open it till she'd left. She'd been staying with us for quite a few weeks.
No conversation, just a packet of pads left behind.
No, this is for one fine. She did say, she was quite poetic. This, darling, this is for one fine spring day. And I had no idea what she meant. I'd been reading Judy Blume novels, so I was a bit confused about the belts and the straps and stuff that they spoke about in those novels. So I was a bit relieved to discover there was an option, but I don't remember what flowed after that. I don't remember who ever bought me what I needed. I left home at 15, went to boarding school for a little bit, and then from boarding school, I was actually broken out of boarding school by my boyfriend and went and lived with him. So I don't have a lot of memory of those conversations at home with my mum.
I think we need to pause for a moment and just talk about the great escape from boarding school. So whereabouts were you?
I got sent to Charters Towers. If no one's ever been to Charters Towers, it's inland from Townsville. I was there twice. The first time, somewhat willingly, the first time I was like, oh, I'll give that a go because I wasn't going to school and I was pretty bright, but I wasn't going. We were hanging out at the skate park all day. No one at school had even really noticed I wasn't going. And I could feel myself slipping away from any sort of path of education. So initially I said I'd go. I went for half a term and then it was Christmas break. And I had a pretty wild Christmas break. I went from Cairns down to Byron by myself and just hung out with some friends and did whatever I wanted. And on returning to Cairns, there was no way I was going back. Had about 3 weeks up there just with friends and then got taken to boarding school by my parents, very reluctantly. And I was there about 3 days and my boyfriend and his friends rocked up one night with their mohawks and twin fins in their old Ford and came into the dorm and broke me out. It was pretty great.
And where did you go to from there?
I went to my boyfriend's house, which happened to be a house where most of our friends sort of lived or were in the middle of Cairns. And it was great. That was it. I remember my mum turning up and saying, can she live here now? And my boyfriend's mum saying, okay. And that was it.
Do you feel like that communal way of living became a lot about creating a new version or a new narrative around what family looked like?
It taught me a lot about, I'd always felt like when I was younger, we moved a lot. And I remember quite liking there being a lot of people in our lives. So we'd go from place to place, depending on where my dad had work, which was basically Byron to the northern beaches of Sydney, back to Byron, and then to the Bloomfield River, which was an incredible experience, then back to Byron. And then we went and ran a youth hostel in Cairns. So really social, lots going on. And then my parents obviously reached a stage in life where things got a bit more stressful. Mortgage payment, all that sort of stuff became a bit of a hard slog. I think Australia was going through a serious sort of financial crisis at the time. Mortgage rates were going through the roof and there was just a lot of stress and the world got quite small. And I remember not liking it. I remember being quite suffocated by it. And then a few years later, living in that situation and living between Cairns and Cape York, surrounded by lots of people, it definitely worked for me. Knowing that the pot of food on the stove would be to share with whoever walked through the door, it just worked. It really did. It made me feel like life wasn't stagnant. I still have an issue with stagnation in life. I don't like it.
And I guess when you've got, you know, all of your children and all of the nurturing space that's required for them, the steadiness, and for each and every child, of course, there's a whole different variation or version of you that's needed to meet what they require, that can be quite a stagnant space, even though there's so much dynamically going on. So how do you meet that feeling of still needing that movement and flow within such a big family?
These days, I don't prioritize, but work is part. Actually, I don't prioritize. That's the wrong word. Whenever I introduce something else into our life or my life, all becomes part of it. I don't compartmentalize. I've introduced them all to the fact now that I go to work in our shop and they're getting the hang of that. initially there was a bit of, well, we want to come too all the time. And they did quite a bit in the beginning, but it doesn't work because I grow flowers here. I just start to talk in the morning about what my day entails, and then off I go and do what I need to do outside of the house. But we just keep moving. I just make it work. I just, that's what life, whatever life brings, I just make it work. And that's how I think I've always been. I change parameters for whatever the need is. I am very solution focused as a human. I learned that terminology when I was studying community development. That is my nature, and I'm accepting of that about myself these days. I don't sit in the pulling apart of the emotional space of something very much. I definitely go, okay, what can we do here, and keep moving.
Quite extraordinary to witness, actually, just the way that you do flux with each circumstance that life throws at you. And there have been some enormous ones, which we're going to get to in this conversation. I want to go back, though, to a few things that we've touched upon.
Yep.
Firstly, this pregnancy with Kaya. So you got your first dose of pregnancy hormones, and you felt, by the sounds of things, quite empowered in that. You felt like you'd met a new version of you that suited you very nicely. In then becoming, knowing you were becoming a mother for the very first time, do you remember having thoughts about what family really looked and meant to you that might have been very different to how you were raised?
The first thing I did when I found out I was pregnant was grab one of my girlfriends and say, we're going on a holiday. So we took off to northern New South Wales for a bit. I introduced her to one of my friends, and she didn't come home with me, and she stayed down here. So I took off for about 6 weeks, I think. That's the first thing I did. And then when I felt like I'd got something, it felt like I needed to get something out of my system, actually. So I don't remember consulting or saying to my baby daddy, are you all right with this? I just said, this is what I'm doing. Then when I got back, he was living up on Cape York. So I remember jumping on a really little aeroplane and heading up there. And I was 4 months pregnant at that stage. And then being happy to just be up there with him. And I do remember conversations about, we'd seen other people have kids young around us. And I do remember saying, and him saying, hey, we're going to do this really well. You know, that sort of naivety that can be there. But there was a desire to, hey, let's do this really well. I do remember our families not really reacting in the way that I felt was supportive once our baby was born. And in retrospect, they were my age now. And I think it was a lot for them to really deal with. So I went and got myself a little house by myself in Karanda, actually, and a friend moved in for a bit. So no, I just took each step as it came. It was like, oh, okay, that's not going to work. My parents can't really handle all of this. I'll go get a place here. My baby daddy went back to Cape York because that was where he needed to be. Then I remember moving us down to Nimbin for a bit just because I felt like I wanted to do my own thing. So no, look, there was no big master plan. There never has been for my life. I take it very moment to moment and do what I need to do.
So there's 18-year-old Hannah, yeah, 4 months pregnant.
Yeah.
Life on up in the Cape York. Can you really go into the details and describe what that life looked like?
We had a share in a community that was 63,000 hectares. From memory, that's the size of the community. And Kaya's dad had bought a share in that community the year before. But prior to that, we had lived up on Cape York together on another lease, which actually was where there was a lot of our friends all living together. So on this community, we had our own place. It had two houses already, you know, temporary sort of North Queensland style Cape York houses pre-built onto it. And we lived near the mouth of a big river, so we could get out to the ocean really easily. We grew a lot of food. We were there through the wet. There was a lot of tropical ulcer issues for me. I've always had quite an allergy to mosquitoes. So it was kind of, you know, there were worries. I was pregnant and getting a lot of tropos on my legs. It was beautiful. It was a wake up in the morning. What do we need to do for today? Really chop wood, carry water, catch fish, eat the fish, growing our garden. And this was part of where my gardening joy really started, from the materials that were accessible to us out there. We'd collect seaweed and wash it down and make seaweed, liquid seaweed, liquid fertilizer from any rotten animals or fish carcass. We'd go out to an island and collect the guano, the pigeon dung from the island. It was really a beautiful experience. I was so healthy and strong and very probably capable of giving birth from living that experience.
There was a fair amount of, you know, going back to a sort of almost like a different time of chopping wood and lighting fires and dragging carcasses. You really must have some wild stories and wild memories from that time, just based around fundamental survival.
Yeah, which, like, you know, everything I've said to you thus far really works for me. It does. It really works for me. Looking around the house at what needs to be done on any given day is the motivation to just get things done. And it was the same living up there. I've got memories of one of our dogs being attacked by a pig and realizing that we just had to stitch him up, you know, and that was just what had to happen. I remember going on a cow hunt to get a clean skin cow, which is a little bit dodgy, to swap the meat in the wet season for dugong and seafood with the local Aboriginal community up there, and having to take the head off a cow, open it up, get its guts out. My owls was pregnant with a little baby, then them saying, oh, that meat's good, like, you know, really wild stuff, but it's practical living real stuff, you know, and that works for me. I get the purpose of that, in that I don't have, there's no freak out because it has a purpose, it has a point. So that sort of living does work for me. I don't seek that out as a necessary desire to have to live that way all the time, but when it's presented to me, I'm just fine.
So tell me about your birth plan.
Oh, what's that?
So there you are. You're living incredibly remotely, and yeah, you know, you're getting obviously towards the pointy end of the pregnancy. Yeah. What were your thoughts about where and how you were going to birth Kaya?
I had a few checkups, doctor's checkups at Lockhart River, at the Aboriginal community that was closest to us. And I remember being mortified for those young women that they still couldn't birth on country. It was really shocking to me. I'd assisted a home birth midwife, so seen women successfully birth in their homes for a couple of years already. And just realizing that these young women who were so tied to this land and so tied to their family ties there had to get on a plane, they had no choice, and go all the way to Cairns, which was, you know, a 13-hour drive, so a really long way away, and they could take one support person. My feeling was with those women actually when I was quite young, because I knew that for me it wasn't a biggie, that when I got to Cairns there was all these people, there was all this support. So I knew I couldn't birth on the Cape. I had 2 weeks to go to my due date and decided it was time to do something about it. So I jumped on the barge because I couldn't fly at that stage, and it had been the wet and the roads were still blocked. It was April, Kaya was born. So we got in our dinghy. We had a 16-foot dinghy, and there were 25, 26-foot crocodiles in that river. It's pretty wild up there. They haven't stopped. The culls stopped, I think, in the late 70s of crocodiles. So there's big crocs up there. There was. That's 20 years ago. So they'd be, you know, dinosaurs now. But we would croc spot down the river, got out to the ocean, then headed about half an hour down the coast to where we met a barge, where they lowered a dinghy down the side of a massive barge to winch me up into it. And I waved guy's dad goodbye and headed down the coast to have a baby. It was a night and a day trip. And then Kaya was overdue. All my babies have been overdue. So I actually had a few more weeks than I thought in Cairns before I went into labour. My midwife was there, though. I was really supported. I never felt like it wasn't going to be fine, to be honest. Kaya's labour wasn't the sort of labour that I'd anticipated, but, you know, that's how it was. And I just went with that too. He was beautiful.
He gave you a couple of days of adventuring, didn't he? Before he decided he'd travel that short distance from uterus to the outside world.
Oh, yeah, he did. It was home for 24 hours. So I remember his labour started getting big boxy contractions. The next morning was kicked full into gear all through that day. and into that night. So that was 24 hours from when it first kicked off, and then to hospital, which I was really reluctant to do, but my home birth midwife was really adamant. So then through that night, through the next day and into the next night, and he was born, and he was exhausted. It was definitely, if not tougher for him, I just remember, and knowing his nature now and the person that he was, he definitely had that feeling of him at birth of, oh, sorry, Mum. Sorry, Mum, that was really tiring. And just beautiful, just instantly beautiful. Yep.
There's such an extraordinary learning about a love that's unknown, isn't there, with the birth of a first child. And if you haven't experienced that within your own family unit growing up, it can be quite shocking. Did you experience that in any way, that the love was just so different to anything that you knew about?
Look, I really don't think in the early days there was any separation between us. It was, I think I learned to love myself a hell of a lot more, to be honest, in loving him. He was him. I didn't have a real affinity with children in general. I wasn't a baby. I mean, I'm astounded by babies, but like we talked about earlier, I didn't have a master plan of having heaps of babies. I didn't want to be, I didn't see being a mum as my role in life, but it wasn't a baby. It was Kaya. And I just adored him. I was so proud of him. He was so incredible. He got so big and so gorgeous so quickly.
Monkey. I remember that very clearly in meeting him the first time and going, that's a good, solid baby.
He was a big Buddha. He was, God, he was incredible. And my feeling about it is just that he was just so perfect. He was just my perfect baby. And my husband now remembers meeting Kaya, because we were in the same world back in those days, when he was probably about at his peak, so about 8 months old, and I was tiny, and just going, oh, my God, that poor woman, look at the size of her baby. And I was like, he was perfect. What are you talking about? He was beautiful. Oh, no, by walking, he'd evened out. So he just had that incredible breastfed bounty on him. And his Chinese genetics, I think his dad's dad was the same sort of big, big, beautiful, round Asian baby. So, yeah. Beautiful.
So there's a real juiciness about you hormonally, for want of a better word, where you are a fertile literal breeding ground. And I imagine you and your husband still have to even be cautious about having conversations about sex that you might fall pregnant. Getting back to your cycle leading into
the horror.
Would it be a nightmare now? Would you be, if you got pregnant now, would you be, would that be difficult?
Look, I made a conscious decision when, we haven't talked about this, but when we lost Kaya, my first thought, I said out loud in the hospital, we have to make another baby so he'll come back. I remember saying those words really clearly, and Jesh sort of looking at me like, oh, shit, she's serious. And then really quickly sinking into, no, that's not how this works. And actually we can't have any more kids because he won't get to meet them. That was within an hour of that.
Let's go in at this entry point, because it's now, and there'll be a lot of shocked ears right now of people not seeing this coming, that you had, for 2018, you had a life, and it was one way. And then after a particular morning, life became very different. It would remain different forevermore and continue to morph in that difference, of course. But there was that life before November 2018 and then after. Can you speak of that moment, that morning of being at home and receiving the phone call that would change everything?
Yeah, I'd spoken with Kaya we'd messaged the night before about could he borrow some money to just top up the month's rent, and we had a big chat about how things were going, and backwards and forwards into sort of probably about 11 o'clock at night. So when the phone rang really early, I think just before 6, I said to Jess, gee, I didn't know we needed the money that early, because I hadn't done the transfer yet. And it was his housemate calling to let us know that something had happened, but he was possibly still going to be okay at that stage, is what they were saying on the phone. And, you know, yeah, the process started of the spin out. And I'd lost my nephew. We'd lost our nephew. My sister-in-law had lost her son. Kyra had lost his cousin a year, just over a year before. And I remember being out the front on the riverbank at one stage, just screaming that I didn't want to be her, strangely, because I'd watched her pain and I'd watched her life just become something that she'd never envisaged. And I knew that he was gone at that point, even though the medical team was saying that he'd possibly still be okay. But I felt he came, I felt him die that morning. And we went down to him on life support for a few days. But, yeah, I knew he'd gone. And I had an inkling of what was about to begin from witnessing my sister-in-law's experience. So, yeah, the blinkers were off. I was definitely not deluded about what changed. But Kaya really held us for that first 2 weeks. And what I was afraid of after witnessing what I was, you know, my perception of my sister-in-law's experience anyway from the outside didn't come in that form. It was really different to what I expected. And it's not, I wouldn't say it's harder now, but it's different and it's more tiring and we're deeper in now. It's been coming up to, it'll be 3 years in November since we lost Kaya, and it changes, but it deepens, and yeah, maybe it does get harder.
Yeah. Is it seeing, I suppose, these years in now coming up to 3 years, you're starting to perceive the longevity of this situation?
Yeah, it's forever. Yep. And forever was a promise when he was born. You know, when you have a baby really young, everyone has, you're much more, I mean, everyone has an opinion on pregnancy anyway. Pregnant women will understand what I mean by that, or people that have ever been pregnant, people throw their opinions at you. I always felt like they just felt like it was actually an opportunity to break the ice. It was a good way for strangers to, you know, try and start up a conversation, which is probably a generous way of looking at everyone's opinions. But yeah, I was told that it was forever. You know, it's going to be forever. You're 18. Are you sure you want to do this? And I've been pretty pissed off about that as the last few years have ticked along, that it wasn't, that actually that's not a guarantee when you have a baby, that they will outlive you, and that the experience of them being with you here on this earth is not forever. And I was told so often that it was. It's tough.
That moment that you receive that phone call from Kaya's flatmate, you then obviously have to go into that response mode. You're gathering up a house full of children of varying ages.
Let's think. Albie was two. Albie was two and Peachy was 14. Yeah.
You're gathering up everybody to go down into what's going to be the most immersive experience, I imagine, of your life. One thing that I really recall that stuck with me of many things of that time is the way that you allowed, as Kaya's mother, ownership for him of what was happening for him at that time. You allowed him to be empowered in his passing, which I just found extraordinary. And can you talk me through your just way of being with him and what was going on for him and how you held that space to not let anybody else's stories filter into that experience at that time?
Yeah, look, it was a no-brainer for me, and it wasn't a conscious, I'm going to do it this way. For me, this was my son's experience. You know, we are here from this date to that date. You know, we're given dates of life, and this was Kaya's death. And just as importantly as his birth, it was on his terms. It was on the terms of what it was meant to be for him. And no one else was going to derail that for me. There were, you know, of course, it's humans and it's messy, and there were people that were having huge experiences around me, but the focus was not going there. the focus for me was on Kaya's death, and there were people that were affected by how I chose to deal with it, but still it didn't take my focus because he was front and center. It was his death and it was to be his ceremony of life, and that was the focus. I mean, like you said, we had all these children who were very much, I was still very much nurturing, and my husband very much nurturing and getting them through. That was also really important to me. I was still breastfeeding. But yeah, the noise, the bigger noise of the world, just like in birth, in death, it didn't come in. I just had no time for it. And I was very well clear of what was at the center. And this is something that I feel really, you know, is a really important teaching, that there is a wheel of grief and there is the death of the person right there in the center of the wheel. And then there are the immediate people that are experiencing that death and being with that death process. And then there's the next step out and the next step out. And you never take from those that are the further step in from you. You just give in. So I was aware of where people sat in that wheel. And if they were attempting to take from me, my boundaries were very solid and continue to be. You know, reach out to someone that can feed you. Don't go in to that person in grief. And I think we can use that model for pretty much any huge experience in life.
Birth and death.
Yeah.
Both stirred the largest parts of what is actually at the essence of a human experience. And yep, everything else we realize is just fluff on the top. And that what that also stirs in other people around us is so unexpected. And like in the way that you've approached everything else, you just, it rises and you have to deal with it as it comes, as you've done just so incredibly. This comparisons that you've made between birth and death, this incredible absorption to that moment at the polar opposite ends of the life spectrum. With birth, there is all of these physical, visceral responses that happen as your body's changed with the birthing of that baby, what's happening hormonally in the system, you know, the plummeting of progesterone that happens once the baby's born, and then all of these processes that have to follow then to create milk, to nurture that baby, the oxytocin, all of these things. At the other end of the spectrum, do you recall visceral physical responses in your body to that tragedy?
Completely. You know, going into birth, like I touched on earlier, my midwife had said to me, trust your body, your hormones will hold you. This is what our bodies are made for this. And I had the same experience with his death. I knew what I needed to do. My husband really trusted that what was coming up for me was appropriate for the time, and it held him too. We really felt Kaya holding us as well, and we were really focused in on him. The morning of coming home from the hospital to my friend's place where we could finally relax, I remember starting a bleed, really heavy bleed, when I could finally let it go. So this is, let me think, 4 days after arriving in Melbourne, and then organ donation happened on day 3. We left the hospital. We weren't comfortable with where we were staying. And when we finally found somewhere to stay and to be, my body just, and my bleeding started. And I went to bed for, you know, a couple of hours for the first time really, and started to cocoon and nurture myself a bit more physically. I'd been out there. I'd been, like in birth, I'd been on that plane for those few days. So yeah, my body was very in tune. And then in the coming month after his death, I'd start to bleed pretty much on those dates, and I still bleed those dates of each month.
For you in having relationship with your cycle after that, obviously for many, many months, I imagine there might have even potentially been a disconnect from the subtlety of the cycle. I'm not sure if that's true for you. But when you were starting to become more aware of your cycle again underneath that enormous load of grief, had it changed?
I remember speaking to you about this in the early days, because what was happening So no, not a disconnect, the opposite, actually. I'm very in my body. That's how I exist. So I was noticing that just before I bleed in that intense time, the grief was too much. So I get through the month and use those times of high energy to move and get things done. And then in the week before my bleed, I would go into a grief that I felt was unmanageable, that I didn't know if I would survive it. Every month, that's how I'd feel. And then I'd start to bleed. So with speaking with you and with, you know, really processing what was happening for myself, I decided that in that time beforehand, rather than go into the grief, I would actually consciously not go there in that week for self-protection. So I would recognize what was happening for myself emotionally and choose to not do it. When the bleed would come, I'd start to allow the feelings to come again once there'd been the release.
In such a what can be a weighty time anyway for many women in their cycle, the week before the bleed, which is very much about that introspective starting to, whether you want to see it or not, what's sitting within you rises to the surface and it's amplified, things that you have the energy and the emotional steadiness to deal with it. Other parts of the cycle become unwieldy for many women, even at the best of times. How did you actually manage to do that? So what did you use in that week before the bleed and knowing that it was coming to not sink into such a powerful pull of that grief in the luteal phase? What tools did you use to stay afloat for that week?
So fortunately for me, I don't and I never have had significant pain through that time frame. It is very emotional. It's not a physical. I get a bit dizzy these days coming into that perimenopause sort of space. I do get a little bit dizzy and I need to drink a lot more water and find the ground. But I grow flowers. That's what I do for my job. And I would go outside at 6 in the morning and not come back inside until the sun was going down. I'd stay in my physical body as much as I could. And there is a written account of my grandma. My grandma wrote a book that talks about the death of her first child. I didn't take inspiration from her, but I read it again later and went, oh, there's our DNA in action. She speaks about standing at the kitchen sink with a desire to run. She had two other small children in the house and knowing that if she started running, she would cross the line into madness and instead going outside and digging in her garden. And I found incredible solace doing the same thing, getting my hands into the actual microbial reality of the earth. And there's starting to be more studies in what that actually offers human beings. And the physical, just the complete physical exhaustion that I would allow myself to feel.
You lost your beautiful Kaya Blue and from there you grew flowers.
So I was growing flowers prior to Kaya's death. I started growing flowers when we moved back out here to the Richmond River, where to a little town called Korokai. We live on the edge of the river out here in the end of 2014. So, you know, nearly 4 years before we lost Kaya. And I'd started to grow flowers then. And didn't really, you know, I was selling wholesale and I just knew I liked it. I'd studied textile design when I was younger and loved doing studio work, but I had so many babies that it just wasn't a reality to be able to be creating solo in a studio. So it was something I could do outdoors. I could stop and start whenever anyone needed me. They could join in if they felt like it. So it served a lot of purpose in my life. And I discovered that there was a need. I went down a rabbit hole of the fact that there really wasn't a lot of small-scale flower producers in this area, in this subtropical climate, and started to hook up with a couple of people doing it and saw that we couldn't grow nearly near enough to really challenge the import industry. So I was at that stage when we lost Kaya. I had a field of flowers out there when we got back because it was summer, from the experience of his death. And I didn't think I could ever pick them. I felt like I'd just leave them to die in the field. And people started wanting them, people that knew I was growing them. And it got me moving. My practical self, we needed money. It's an expensive reality to lose someone. And we were all struggling to function and work. And so I started picking them and forward planning, which you do with flowers. So it definitely, the flowers kept me moving and seeing a future, because you need to know what seeds are going in. So in 3 months, you'll have more flowers. So it kept me in that cycle, which of the seasons, which was incredibly beneficial. And then within the first year of his loss, I had an opportunity to open a shop up in Yoruba. I didn't know if I was ready for it. We were all going to Splendor, which was our celebration of Kaya. Splendor in the Grass Music Festival was happening. And at the same time, I had to open this shop. And I just decided it was all okay. This is what's being offered to me. I'm just going to do it. We've had a shop in Yoruba now for 2 years, and we're just on this two-year mark. Tomorrow we take over the lease of a bigger space up there in the same shop but by ourselves now, to just be able to further expand this world of locally grown flowers, small-scale flowers, people knowing where their flowers come from, collaborating with some incredible local flower artists, flower designers, because we've created, or we've found ourselves to become part of a really great community that, as a job and as something that we can put out in the world every day, doesn't have a downside. You know, it's minimizing plastic waste, it's minimizing miles, it's reducing agricultural practices that have a negative impact on the planet. We're building soil, we're growing flowers, we're bringing them to people that wouldn't have access to those sorts of flowers. You know, it is a really wonderful way to spend my days. And it didn't have a lot of forward planning, like everything we've talked about today. It presented itself to me and I just ran with it, and I'm still running with it.
So, it's so beautiful. I mean, I just think, wow, this social media is a funny world for me, and I always struggle, even though I know that my life is extraordinary, but I struggle to place the extraordinary elements of my life into a social media context. And I look around and I see lots of people somehow making the ordinary everyday moments look like extraordinary things on social media. And then your social media comes through my feed and it's just an explosion of happiness. That's the vibration that even comes through the screen. And I think that's an amazing, like, it's an incredible thing to be putting out there in the world. One thing that really struck me in the creation of this, or the growth of this business for you, as we sat down and had a conversation one day, and I had no idea that there was this world of imported flowers that were also sprayed with all kinds of chemicals for preservation, for that transportation cross globally. And some of those chemicals, of course, affected respiration in these things that are designed for us to experience, not just visually, but through smell. That's such an important component of flowers. And I think we've all noticed the loss of the smell of flowers over the years. Flowers were being sprayed with things that would not just affect potentially my respiration, but also affect my hormonal system as these parts of nature that are so deeply connected to the joy of the human heart. And somehow we've perverted them as human beings to be something almost dangerous to a woman's hormonal system.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. And it's essential when you bring anything that's plant matter into this country that it has a biosecurity process to go through, because we need to really look after this incredible island that we live on, regarding its, you know, the animals, you know, the insects, and not introducing some other, you know, insect that could ravage this country, but also with disease, fungal disease. So biosecurity is really important. And even though those chemicals are heavy, it's essential that anything that comes into this country is treated by quarantine. So that involves chemicals. So if you want to avoid those chemicals with your flowers and with your food, you know, you don't buy imports. The problem in Australia is there is no ticketing to let people know that there's no sticker to say that it's an imported product. So for flowers, it's really tricky. The only way that you can know for sure, because often florists won't know the origin of their flowers because they go to the flower market and there's no stickering, so they often don't know they're buying imports, is to and actually know for sure where they're grown. So that's what we're offering people, and that's what, you know, there's little pockets of this all around Australia. It's a really growing reality that there's growers in communities that are supplying their community with flowers that are in season for that region, that grow in that region, and support each other collectively to make sure there's enough, because, you know, growing on a small scale means you can grow organically and you can grow regeneratively much more easily than a huge, gigantic flower farm can. But it means collectively you're stronger because there's more flowers available to people. And we love it in that way, that we're opening people's eyes to an industry that is really quite toxic. And people come to the shop and often say to me, oh, you've ruined other flowers for me. It's like when you discover that lollies really aren't good for you. You know, they look so great and they, oh, it's exciting, but oh, the reality is that, you know, that gorgeous fruit over there is actually a lot better for you than the lollies are. It's a similar experience for people. And
I'm going to say that your flowers have changed my love and my relationship with flowers. I've always adored in nature, but there was always a sort of a bit of a block for me in receiving flowers, as much as I loved a lovely gesture and I love the look of things. But I think once I was realizing that the scent of flowers, that something was happening, and that they'd also almost always come wrapped in plastic, and that was something that was really difficult for me to get beyond. And but there's a complete joy, and like you were saying before, that there's no negative in getting a bunch of your flowers. Everything about the experience is positive. And even as those flowers begin to fade in color, your flowers sustain in this beautiful new way in these gorgeous dried bunches, which are all over my house.
And you could almost talk about the cycle of life right there. I mean, flowers for me are a representation of the incredible impermanence of this experience. You know, they are so beautiful. They take your breath away. They smell, you know, the smell of some of the garden roses especially. And we've got a succession of stock flower coming through right now. It just smells like cloves. It's so just wild, the scent of it. And then they do fade and they do change and, as you say, remain beautiful. I could say the same thing about, you know, this story of grief that we've spoken about. You know, there is an incredible beauty in the fact that our sun existed. Life is not horror right now. It didn't change from beautiful flowers to dead, wilted nightmare. There is still an incredible beauty in the fact that Kaya was alive for 22 years, you know, and it's the flowers represent that to me. Whether I'm always aware of it or not, it's definitely part of this experience of bringing beauty to life and beauty that is impermanent.
Thank you for just being an incredible human being, for being always an inspiration, and for giving me so much of your incredibly pressurized time.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for talking to me. I love our friendship too.
If you've got a question, you'd like to suggest a guest, or get in contact with myself, Lissy Turner, yoga therapist, or with Talia Minot, holistic nutritionist, www.livingharmoniously.com. Hope you can join me for next episode of Living Harmoniously, the podcast.